So we are studying this quarter about these 12 men that Jesus chose to be his special ambassadors, the men who would carry out the and carry on the work that he began when he was here upon this earth. And thinking about those, really about that last year and a half, maybe couple of years or so, near the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, where he spent time with them. Of course, these guys would go on to do some really important work, but we're really kind of focusing him on the time while they were with him and what the Bible reveals about these 12 men, about their character, about their personality, what kind of things can we learn from them, the successes and the failures of these men. And these are ordinary men. They're just regular folks. Many of them are blue-collar type folks. And so we're just trying to see what's the relation with those guys and what we can learn from their example and how we can be more and more like Christ. These men were molded and shaped by their time with Jesus, and we want to be molded and shaped in that same way. Really up to this point, we've been looking at really kind of some pairs, some very well-known pairs amongst the apostles. Peter and Andrew were brothers, James and John, which were brothers. Last week we talked about Philip, and really in some ways it seems as if Nathanael, the apostle we're going to study this evening, really seems like he maybe kind of pairs up with Philip a little bit. They're always kind of mentioned together, and especially in the text that we'll study this evening in John the first chapter. Of course, Nathanael is maybe not generally known to us as Nathanael. If you grew up like I did, singing that 12 Apostles song, Jesus called them one by one, then you probably know him better by the name Bartholomew, which I always thought was kind of a cool name. You don't hear the name Bartholomew, maybe Bart, but you don't hear the name Bartholomew today. And in fact, in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke and in Acts, that's the way he's always referred to, is by the name Bartholomew. However, in the one instance that we have kind of some dialogue from this gentleman is in John chapter 1, and in that instance, he's referred to as Nathanael. And so for our purposes this evening, I am going to refer to him as Nathanael. The name Bartholomew may have actually been kind of a surname. There's lots of times in the Bible where the name Bar something usually means son of someone else. Think about Peter. He's referred to as Simon Bar-Jonah. That is, Simon the son of a man named Jonah or John. Bartholomew may have been the same way. He may have been the son of a guy by the name of Tholomew, or maybe the Hebrew name would have been Tolmai. And so maybe his full, you know, name that we would think of, first name, last name, Nathanael Bartholomew. That's one possibility with all of that. But the only real insight that we do have to Nathanael's kind of his character and kind of some specific things about him is found in John the first chapter. And so I invite you to turn over to John chapter 1. We've visited this passage two or three times already because this chapter kind of serves as the launching point for the interactions that several of these men first have with Jesus. And that's going to be the case once again this evening with Nathanael. I want to just read this account. We read part of it last week because the story of Philip is included here. But we're going to finish out the remainder of that passage. And as we read these verses, I'm going to ask you to pay careful attention to verse 46. And as we read that, I want you to just think about what would your initial reactions be about this man, just based on that one verse, that first kind of introduction to him. In John chapter 1, read with me if you will, beginning in verse 43. John 1, 43, the next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee, and he found Philip, and he said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Now, verse 46 is kind of that first word of dialogue that we have recorded for us of Nathanael. based on that statement that he makes in response to Philip. Philip says, hey, we found the Messiah. I'm just confident of this. The response that Nathanael gives there in verse 46, if the story had maybe ended right there, what would be your impressions of Nathanael? What's going on in this guy's mind or in this guy's heart? All right, doesn't think much of Jesus. Is that because he knows a lot about Jesus? All right, he's kind of jumping to some conclusions based on where Jesus is from. I've titled this lesson, Nathanael the Bigot. That might seem like a really harsh term to use here, but I think it is fair to say there's some prejudice kind of at work here in Nathanael's mind. Some bias at bare minimum, maybe some narrow-mindedness, maybe even some ignorance going on here. Nathanael, we learn in chapter 21, verse 2, is from the little town of Cana in Galilee, which was only about 5 or 6 miles north of Nazareth. And so he probably would have been somewhat familiar with Nazareth. If you lived in that area of Galilee, then you probably knew about all the little towns and the villages round about. And so perhaps some of these prejudices that he just immediately has about Nazareth when he makes this statement, can anything good come out of Nazareth? It may have been the kind of thing that had been kind of just hardwired into his mind ever since he was a youngster. He may have just been told all his life, stay away from Nazareth. Nothing but just riffraff from over there, trash over there, stay away from that area. That's kind of the seedy part of town. And Nazareth was known for being kind of a rough town. You know, Galilee itself, just the whole region of Galilee, was not thought very highly of in first century times. If you were a Jew, really kind of the epicenter of Judaism, would have been, of course, right in Jerusalem. But people in Galilee were not thought real highly of. They were kind of seen as kind of lower class. Of course, a lot of the people that lived there were people who were blue-collar type people, fishermen like Peter and Andrew and James and John and these guys. They were not really well-educated. They were not super cultured. And if that was true of people in Galilee, that was especially true of people who came from Nazareth. Just wasn't thought very highly of at all. It's believed that maybe in the time when Jesus grew up in Nazareth, that Nazareth may have been a village of no more than about 500 people. Just a little bump on the log type of place. It's not even mentioned in the Old Testament. You don't see any reference to a town called Nazareth. It just wasn't really well known. People who lived there would have known about Nazareth, but beyond that, nobody really would have thought very much of them. Nazareth, where it's situated, is not close enough to the Sea of Galilee or to the Mediterranean Sea, so you didn't have like travel routes going through there. People didn't really have any reason to ever go through Nazareth, and so Nazareth was just not very well respected. It was not very refined. It was not considered a place where anything good comes from. One commentator, he actually said this. He said, Judeans, in general, look down on Galileans, but even the Galileans look down on the Nazarenes. And so, maybe Nathanael's response here in verse 46, maybe when he says, can anything good come out of Nazareth, maybe some of that is just how insignificant Nazareth is, kind of in the grand scheme of things, in the grand picture of the world. Maybe it's because of just kind of the reputation of Nazareth and the kind of people who normally do come out of Nazareth, rough people and people who were kind of looked at in a certain sort of way. Whatever it was, what I just want us to see here is that Nathanael is making a judgment that's really based on a stereotype or maybe even a geographic prejudice. And the fact of the matter is, that still happens today, doesn't it? Don't we do that? I haven't lived in Middle Tennessee long enough to quite figure out what are considered kind of the seedy areas around Nashville. But where I came from in Somerset, Kentucky, it was almost just kind of a running joke. The little town that was a little south of us, Monticello, Kentucky. If you came from Monticello, stay clear of that guy. Monticello was known for all kinds of things. Lots of crime, lots of drugs, just not a lot of highly educated folks come out of Monticello. Lots, again, kind of like blue-collar type folks. And so it's just kind of almost an inside joke. Monticello, bunch of losers come out of there. That kind of thing still happens even to this day. And it happened a lot in the Bible. This instance here in John 1, verse 46 is not the only example of this. In fact, if you're there in John, just flip over a couple of pages. Look in chapter 7. In John chapter 7, this kind of geographical prejudice, it's all over the New Testament. In John chapter 7, there's a conversation happening here between Nicodemus and some other people, and they're talking about Jesus. And this group of people then say to Nicodemus, John chapter 7, verse 52, they replied, "Are you from Galilee too? Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee." Of course, that's not the only example of that. In Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, there in Acts 2, verse 7, when the apostles are speaking in, you know, all these tongues, what's the response of the people? All the people are astonished and amazed, and they're saying, "These are Galileans. There are Galileans up there talking in other languages. These people aren't smart enough to know other languages." Again, that was just kind of the reputation that people had built in their mind, which again, a lot of that may have just been kind of stereotyped throughout the years. And that sort of thing is working here in Nathanael's mind, where he's kind of got some stereotypes about Jesus simply based on where he's from. As far as we know, he doesn't really know anything else about this guy except for the fact that he's from Nazareth. Now, before I go any further, anybody else got anything they want to say about that, that idea of the, I mean, some of the stereotypes that went along with Nazarenes or Philip's, or not Philip, but Nathanael's statement here? That then leads me to then, I wanted to use that as an opportunity, maybe a little bit of a springboard for us to just think a little bit about prejudices, because those sorts of things still happen today. You know, prejudices could have, very well, have prevented Nathanael from ever coming to know the Lord. Again, if the story had ended in verse 46, man, think of all that Nathanael would have potentially have missed out on. Maybe would have never had the opportunity to get to travel with Jesus, to get to be in his company, to get to learn from him, to see the miracles and all the other stuff that he was privileged to do. It would have been a great loss all because of these preconceived ideas, these prejudgments that he had made based on, you know, geographical stereotypes. Which begs the question for us this evening. Do we ever experience that today? Folks maybe kind of keep Jesus at arm's length, keep Christianity at arm's length, keep the church at arm's length because of prejudices that they've built up in their mind. Maybe things that they've heard from others, maybe something they've just, I don't know, read on the internet, something that they've just kind of been told or just commonly thought about the church or about the Bible or about Christians. I know I've certainly seen a lot of that and kind of had to work through some of that. What are maybe some of those prejudices that maybe come to your mind that sometimes prevent people from coming to the Lord? Nobody.
Count the light.
All right.
Our secretary of school one time found out that our PE teacher was a member of the Christian church. He said, "Oh," she said, "Oh no, she's a banjo picking count the light."
All right. So sometimes as soon as folks, you know, hear, you know, you're a member of a Church of Christ, they just immediately in their mind associate that with Alexander Campbell and then just all of the stuff that, again, people have just developed in their mind. Your church started because of Alexander Campbell. That's not true, but that is the kind of misinformation that people have come to believe, little tidbits of truth maybe here and there, and then stretch that to create this entire false idea about the Lord's church and the Lord's people. What's some others? All right, that's a big one. Actually, I had to entertain that question just recently. You folks down there, especially y'all in the Church of Christ, you all just think you're the only ones going to heaven. Everybody else is going to hell, and y'all are just quick to, you know, start pouring the Wesson oil on people and frying them up in hell as quick as you possibly can. And again, that's, I know I don't go around telling people I'm the only one going to heaven and all the rest of you all are going to hell, but again, that is the kind of thinking that a lot of people come to believe about the Lord's church. What else? Yeah, yeah, that we are just, y'all are so judgmental, y'all are so persnickety about stuff, y'all are the people you just demand, you got to have a book, chapter, and verse for everything, and everybody else who doesn't, well, we're all just a bunch of, you know, liberal so-and-sos, and apparently that means we don't care about the Bible, and so yeah, there comes some of that sort of thing. Even, not just even when it comes to religious matters, but we get that kind of stigma as well when it comes to moral matters. You know, we get up and we say things. We say what the Bible says about things like homosexuality or about abortion. And of course, in our culture today, that is very taboo to do. And so the quick, easy label to just throw on us is y'all are just a bunch of judgmental, you know, so-and-sos. And that's just not, it's not fair for you all to go judging me and that sort of thing. What else? Had a conversation with somebody recently who I think was really almost under the impression that in order to be a Christian that you needed to be essentially perfect. That was their view of people who were Christians. Of course, you know, they always saw Christians, you know, being on their best behavior, and so maybe that was partially the reason they had come to believe that and believe that they themselves could never be a Christian, because I could never do that. I could never live up to that standard. But that's not true. No, I don't walk around professing to be perfect or anywhere even close to perfect. Sometimes I encounter folks who believe that Christianity is just for dummies. It's based on blind faith. You know, Christianity doesn't agree with science. And y'all are just a bunch of dummies to even believe what you believe. You just believe that because your mama told you that or your grandpappy told you that. And that's the reason you believe that kind of stuff. It's not based on, you know, actual evidence. That may describe some people's faith, some people who are Christians, but I know that doesn't describe mine. My faith is not built upon some just blind thing that I was told, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid or anything like that. I know what my faith is built on. It's built on evidence. It's built upon God's Word and other pieces of evidence. About just the thought that all Christians are a bunch of hypocrites. I had a conversation with somebody just a few months ago trying to encourage them to come back to the Lord. They had once been a faithful member of the church, and for some time they had been away from the Lord, and they were just quick to just toss out that everybody down there is just a bunch of hypocrites. Are there hypocrites in the church? Probably. In all probability, I'd say that there are. But is it a fair statement to just kind of go blanketly just throwing that on everybody? Oh, everybody down there is a bunch of hypocrites? That's not accurate. That's not fair. And I think that's the kind of thing that we see with Nathanael. Again, he's kind of making a broad, all-encompassing statement. Maybe up to that point in time, maybe not a whole lot of good had ever come out of Nazareth. But what he was going to find out very shortly is that something very good did come out of Nazareth. Just kind of as a follow-up question, thinking about, all right, so we've got a bunch of these prejudices that we've encountered from time to time. What do we do about that? What can we do about that? And I need to just ask that in a general sense. Maybe can't give an answer for each of those specific things that we've cited this evening, but what can we do to combat some of that prejudice that folks just immediately have about us or about the church or about the Bible?
Was Judas a hypocrite?
Well, his ending certainly wasn't good, but he was counted amongst the 12.
Jesus picked 12 men, one of them was a hypocrite.
Yeah, yeah. Right. So there's maybe kind of a specific answer to the hypocrite charge. What else would be helpful to kind of help curb some of the prejudices that folks have about the Lord's people or the Lord, maybe just the Lord himself? Yeah. 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 You touched on a couple things there. The first one was a good one about we just need to be careful. Yes, we want to defend the truth and defend, you know, what we believe is right, what the Bible teaches. We want to defend the Lord and His church and all that sort of stuff. But we want to be careful not to do something that's just going to reinforce potentially in people's minds some of those stereotypes. What you said secondly is maybe really just about the best thing that we can offer whenever we encounter some of those prejudices, and that is to just do what Philip did. When Philip was presented with this statement by his friend who said, "Oh, nothing good can ever come out of Nazareth," Philip then encouraged him, kind of pushed him a little bit and said, "Hey, won't you come and see? Won't you come and check it out for yourself? Don't just base this based on what you've heard. Don't even base this just simply on what I'm telling you. You come and see for yourself. You come and do some investigating. You come and put some pieces together and then reach a conclusion. It's just never fair to just kind of jump to a conclusion based on secondhand, thirdhand information, misconceptions, and all that sort of stuff. You come and see the evidence for yourself, and then you decide. In fact, maybe you'll come and see, and then at the end of that, you still decide, no, that's not for me, and I don't want anything about that. Okay, that's fine. I'm not going to go shoving something on you don't want. But that's one of the best things that we could possibly do is, okay, well, what have you learned about the church? Well, what is it about the Bible specifically that you have come to see as maybe being false or that you're rejecting it in some way? Can you give me some specific examples there? Garrett made the comment last week about how Philip, you know, didn't just let this statement go. He didn't hear his friend say, nothing good comes out of Nazareth. And then Philip's like, oh, okay, we'll see you later. No. Let's push that a little bit. Let's maybe ask some follow-up questions and see where that can go. Maybe one of the other things that maybe I would offer in combating some of the prejudices that we have is that we just want to be very careful about how we live as God's people. We want to live in such a way that is going to not, again, not reinforce those prejudices, but we want to live in such a way that's going to just combat and tear down those prejudices. If people say Christians are nothing but hypocrites, then well, the last thing I want to do is go around living hypocritically. I want to show people that it is possible to be a New Testament Christian. It is possible to walk in the footsteps of Jesus. It is possible to be salt and to be light in this world, to have a guiding and preserving influence. That's not just some kind of a pipe dream. We believe that that is possible, and we believe that that we can do that with the help of the Lord. That's the kind of thing that we want to do to try to kind of push back against some of those prejudices. I'm not going to try to start some kind of a war in any way, but there are things that we can do to help kind of work people through those things. You know, the truth of the matter is, when you think about Jesus and the statement that was made here about him, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? This is actually part of the plan of God. It was intentional that Jesus would come from very humble beginnings, that he would come even from a despised and rejected hometown. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 1, when you couple that with what's said in Matthew 2 verse 23, this is actually a matter of prophecy. This is a part of God's plan in bringing the Messiah into this world. And what Nathanael would come to realize is that, yes, something good actually does come out of a place that you didn't think very much of. Other thoughts on some of the thoughts about the prejudices and all that before we move on talking about some other things? So thankfully, the story does not end there in verse 46. There is more about Nathanael. Philip says, come and see. And that does lead to him coming and seeing. And one of the things that I love about Nathanael, just from these few verses that we have here in John chapter 1, is that this fella seems like he really has a knowledge and an appreciation of the Scriptures, which of course for him would have been the Old Testament Scriptures, but he seems to be a person of the book. And I think that there are several indicators in this passage. I mean, I've wrote down four or five things here that I think are indicative just in this text here in John 1 that show this was a guy of the book. What are some of those clues? What do you see here that says this guy appreciates the Bible, he knows his Bible, he's about the Scriptures? All right, so when Jesus calls him an Israelite indeed, or truly an Israelite, or an Israelite for sure, that's kind of an indication that Jesus is acknowledging this guy's the real deal. He's not just simply an Israelite in name only. He's truly a person of God, which of course would mean he's a person of the book as well. We'll say more about the Israelite indeed concept here in just a moment. What else in the text? All right. He uses a couple of, actually, not just Son of God. He uses another expression there as a title for Jesus. What's the other one there? King of Israel. How would he know to use those kinds of titles and descriptors for Jesus? Somebody would maybe say, well, it fits, or maybe he was taking a guess. I'm going to say he's using those expressions because they're right out of the Old Testament. In fact, hold your place here in John. Look in Psalm chapter 2. We actually find both of these. In Psalm chapter 2, this is very much a messianic prophecy, the second psalm. In Psalm chapter 2, we actually find both of these terms being used to describe the Messiah, the one that God would send as his anointed. In Psalm chapter 2, in verse 6, the Lord says, as for me, I have set my king in Zion, my holy hill. Then verse 7, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. I'm persuaded Nathanael knew that passage. And so when he kind of puts some pieces together and he comes to Jesus and recognizes who he really is, he's able to say authoritatively what the psalmist said back in Psalm 2, you're that king. You are that son that's being described there. Now, did he understand everything about Jesus? Probably not. Probably maybe didn't even fully grasp the entire implications of referring to him as the king of Israel and as the son of God. But I think that's probably some proof that this guy knew his Bible a little bit. What else here? Garrett? Yeah, when Philip comes to him and he's using terms like law of Moses or prophets and those sorts of terms, that's not a foreign concept to him. He comes and speaks of those sorts of things and then speaks about the one that we've been looking for. It says that he's already got some knowledge prior to this point. In fact, I kind of wonder if maybe Philip and Nathanael, maybe they studied the scriptures together. Maybe could have been the same age. Maybe they lived in the same neighborhood, grew up going to the temple together, and so they've been studying these things and looking for these things for a long time. What else in the text? There's a couple of ideas here that maybe are not so obvious. Yeah. So, of course, rabbis were what? What's another word for a rabbi? A teacher. And what did rabbis teach? They taught the scriptures. At least they're supposed to teach the scriptures. That's not to say that all of them always did. But so the fact that he comes and acknowledges Jesus as a rabbi, as a teacher, he's already kind of he's kind of showing his hand already that, yes, Jesus is a man of authority. He knows the scriptures. And, hey, I'm acquainted with the scriptures. And so I'm coming to learn from you. There's a couple other things that jump out. Verse 46, when he makes that statement about, you know, what could possibly come out of Nazareth, that might indicate that maybe Nathanael was not expecting, even though he was expecting the Messiah, he was looking for him, him and Philip were both looking for him, he may have not been expecting the Messiah to come from a place like Nazareth. I mean, after all, there's nowhere in the Old Testament where the Bible says that the Messiah would come out of Nazareth specifically. He may have been thinking the Messiah was going to come from someplace else. Like, for example, the place that Micah chapter 5, verse 2 references. Would you hold your place in John again? Look in Micah. Not the easiest book in the book. Just go to the Matthew and take a left. You'll eventually find Micah chapter 5. In Micah chapter 5 and in verse 2, here's a place where maybe people would have possibly been looking for the Messiah to come. Micah 5, verse 2, but you, O Bethlehem, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient of days. So there may have been some people, if they were, you know, really good Old Testament students, may have been looking to Bethlehem for the Messiah to come, because that's what that passage speaks of. And of course, Jesus did come from Bethlehem in the sense that that's where he was born. Maybe the first, you know, few weeks or months of his life was spent there. Majority of his life growing up was spent there in Nazareth. And so the sense in which both of those things are true. But my point is that Nathanael may have been familiar with a passage like Micah 5 verse 2. Or maybe some other place in the Old Testament that maybe would have caused him to think that the Messiah would come from a place other than Nazareth. The other thing in the text that might be a clue about Nathanael being a person of the Scriptures is in verse 48, when Jesus spots him sitting under that fig tree. In Jewish culture, especially at that time, sitting under the fig tree was a very common posture for students of the Word. It was a place that you would go if you were in your house, which would normally be probably lots of times be very cramped. You go and sit out under the fig tree. And it was just kind of, you know, kind of a known thing. If you see somebody sitting under the fig tree, maybe they've even got out a piece of scroll or some kind of material that they're reading, most likely they're doing some study. They're doing some Bible study. And maybe when Jesus spots him under the fig tree, Jesus is almost kind of acknowledging, hey, there's a Bible student. There's somebody who's serious about the word. And that, of course, is very evident in the statement that he makes about him being an Israelite indeed. What exactly does that mean? That is that next question there in the class material. What does Jesus mean in verse 47 when he says, Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit? What's that mean? All right. All right, here's somebody who knows the word. He's following it. He's living it. What would we call a person like that? Certainly wouldn't call him a hypocrite, would we? It'd be the opposite. What's the opposite of hypocrisy? Sincerity. There we go. That's the idea here. That's what Jesus is saying when he says, here's an Israelite indeed. In fact, think of other places in the New Testament where Jesus uses that term truly, truly, or when he uses the word indeed. Lots of times, it's conveying that idea of like, that's the genuine thing. That's the real deal there. And that's what he's saying about Nathanael. Here's a guy that Jesus, even though he's never talked to this guy prior to this moment, what he already knows about him, what he's even observed of him from afar, says to him, this guy has a sincere heart. He has integrity. He's not a hypocrite. In fact, even Nathanael's statement that he made there in verse 46, even though it was prejudicial, it was honest. He was sincere in what he said. That's really what he believed about people who came from Nazareth. So there's even indication, even in that statement, that this is a person who truly is living out what he has come to believe and what he knows as being the law of God. You know, Paul uses some similar language in Romans, the 9th chapter. In fact, Romans 9, 10, and 11 all kind of comprise a unit together where Paul's kind of building some of these ideas. But Paul talks about in Romans 9, verses 6 and 7, that not all Israelites were sincere with a nature like Abraham. Paul points out that there were some Israelites who were just hypocrites. And they really were just Israelites in name only. They were just born as Jews. You know, their mom and their dad were Israelites. And so, yeah, I'm an Israelite too, even though I may not even live like one. Maybe meet people like that today in the religious world. I got a friend who's a Catholic, but they'll just tell you, don't even go to a Catholic church. I don't practice any of it. I'm just a Catholic, just in name only. My mom and dad were Catholics. My family are Catholics. And so that's someone that you would not say, oh, they're a Catholic indeed. No, they're absolutely not that. Jesus saw Nathanael. This guy really is truly an Israelite. He's trying to live out fully what he's come to know the law to teach. Again, I'll just reiterate, that doesn't mean Nathanael had everything right. Doesn't mean he had all the knowledge that he needed yet. Didn't have all the wisdom that he needed yet. But he did have a sincere heart. And that's exactly where it has to start. For anybody, I believe, in order to be pleasing to God, it's got to start with a sincere heart. What did Jesus say in Luke chapter 8, verse 15, talking about the seed that fell upon the good soil? He likens that to people who have a good and honest heart. Sincere people who really do want to please the Lord and do what's right. And so, when you just kind of put all that together, Nathanael knew, number one, based on his study of the Old Testament, he knew to be expecting a Savior and a Messiah. Secondly, he had the testimony of his friend Philip to come along and to kind of, you know, verify what he's known. And then thirdly, he got really just kind of convinced himself of Jesus' own omniscience by that, you know, altercation he has with Jesus. And Jesus says, I saw you, and how did you know who I was, and all that sort of stuff. When a truly sincere person then is presented with all those pieces of evidence, then what can you expect? What can you and I expect? When we encounter somebody, they're presented with evidence for maybe the veracity of Scripture. They're presented with the evidence for Jesus as the Son of God. They're presented with what the Bible teaches about how to become a Christian. What do you expect to happen with somebody who's sincere? They're going to what? They're going to follow it. They're going to obey. That's what truly sincere people do. In fact, the moment that you don't do that, the moment that you don't follow the truth, then that's the moment your sincerity goes out the window. But just as was the case with Nathanael, that's what sincere people are going to do. We can expect, verse 49, for that person to be a believer. And if they won't believe based on, you know, multiple evidences like that, then the fact of the matter is, there's a good chance they maybe are never going to believe. And that may be an indication that they just don't have a good heart. But when somebody is inquisitive, somebody's open-minded, somebody is studious like Nathaniel was, and it's just going to come as no surprise that that's going to produce some faith and some belief working in that person's heart, and then that's going to lead to a willingness to act, even in a relatively short period of time. Think about that. This is Nathaniel's first interaction with Jesus, and before you know it, the next thing he's doing is he's following Jesus. It's pretty amazing. And I preached Sunday morning about the Ethiopian eunuch. The fact of the matter is, that guy's conversion happened in a relatively short period of time. I don't know exactly how long that Bible study in the desert took place between him and Philip, but I'm guessing it was probably no longer than maybe a few hours during that afternoon, and that guy's becoming a Christian. Well, how is that possible? We often think somehow it's just impossible for somebody to become a Christian that quickly. But when you got this, when you got a sincere heart, when you've already got good soil to work with, then those sorts of things are possible, and it's not in the realm of impossibility. The Philippian jailer would be another example of that sort of thing. Other thoughts here about the sincerity of Nathaniel and the conversation with Jesus. Yeah. That's right. Jesus talks about by someone's fruits you can know them, and even that, even our own observation in a lot of ways is still going to be limited. We're not going to have perfect vision of everybody. We don't have X-ray vision like the Lord does to see people's hearts, but we need to try to always assume the best and be willing to reach out and to try to help people to come to a knowledge of the truth. Jesus promised, I'll look at that statement that Jesus made to Nathanael there in verse 50. He promised Nathanael that he was going to see greater things. Did Nathanael get to see greater things? Indeed he did. From the moment that he then began to follow Jesus, it would just be, one long series of greater things and greater things. Gets to witness miracles. In fact, in the very next chapter, in John chapter 2, in Nathanael's hometown of Cana, he gets to witness Jesus doing that miracle, that first recorded miracle of turning the water into wine. That, of course, then leads to lots of other miracles he gets to behold. Jesus healing the sick, Jesus driving out demons and unclean spirits, gets to sit in the presence of the greatest teacher ever. That's pretty great and amazing. Then, of course, all that culminates by getting to see the resurrected Lord and getting to watch his ascension back into heaven. He absolutely got to see great things. In fact, even after Jesus was gone, he continued to see great things. Acts chapter 2 and getting to witness all of that on the day of Pentecost. That was amazing. Jesus absolutely got to, his words came true to him. I would just say about verse 51, because we don't have time, and really this class wasn't going to be really conducive to talk about verse 51, that statement there about you're going to see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. There's a couple different ideas about what that means. I think it may be an allusion to the story of Jacob's ladder in Genesis chapter 28, which Nathaniel, being a Bible student, he would have been very familiar with that story, which is really kind of a metaphor for the work of heaven being done here on earth. And how, of course, Jesus was here to do that work upon the earth, and the apostles would continue to carry out that mission. That's maybe just, like I said, a discussion for a later time. Tradition does hold, and we've tried to kind of conclude each week by talking about this. Tradition does hold that Nathanael preached with Philip. They were kind of preaching partners in Phrygia and Hierapolis before he ended up taking the gospel to what we know modern day as Armenia. And supposedly, he converted the king of Armenia. And that didn't set well with the king's family. The king's brother, apparently, was very enraged by that. And so he seized Nathanael and ordered him to be flayed alive with knives and then be beheaded after all of that. And in fact, to this present day, the Armenian Apostolic Church, they honor Nathanael as being their patron saint. Now, I don't subscribe to the Armenian Apostolic Church or what they teach and so forth, but that probably does maybe give some credence to the fact that he had done work in that area and was well known and was revered even after his death, martyred for the faith, just as the others before him, with the exception of John, had done, sacrificed for the cause of Christ. So, that's the story of Nathanael. Parting thoughts before we close this evening. All right, Lord willing, next Wednesday, we'll talk about Matthew, who, of course, we probably know very well in name, and we know some factoids about Matthew, but we'll get to dig a little bit deeper with this tax collector, maybe talk a little bit about the process of taxation and how that worked in New Testament times, and why Nathanael, in a lot of ways, he's almost kind of like the odd one out in this group here. And so we'll talk about Matthew next week. Appreciate your comments and your attention this evening.